Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Sober Indian Saturday Night Live. This is Karen. I'm your host. And tonight we'll be speaking with Lestina Saul. So with no further ado, let's welcome Lestina to the show. Hi, Lestina. How are you this evening?
Hi, I'm doing pretty good. Thank you for having me on here.
Oh, you're very welcome. I think I wanted to kind of start the show off with you telling everybody a little bit about yourself, and then we can just go from there into your story.
Okay. All right. Well, I am from the Sistan-Waukesan Dakota Oyate tribe of North Dakota and South Dakota, but I also have some of my relatives are from the Santee Sioux tribe and the Yankton Sioux tribe in Nebraska and South Dakota. I am a jingle dress dancer, and my dress of choice is old style, and right now I do the red dress for the MMIW movement, so that's something that's dear to me. I have 3 children and 1 grandson, and I live in Omaha, Nebraska.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, I think that's great because you don't even sound like you should have grandchildren.
Yeah, so I was, yeah, that's what I told my daughter. No.
Oh,
but he's the apple of my eye. He really is. He's so cute. He's 2 years old and he'll be 3 pretty soon, and he just brightens up my day.
Oh, I think that's sweet. They are something else, that's for sure. I absolutely agree with you.
Yes.
So I know that you were on your journey to sobriety, and you've made it there. Would you care to kind of share with us a little bit about that journey tonight?
Yes, I would. I can. Do you want me to start now and like start with my life story, or do you want me to start from my recovery? Okay. All right.
You can start from wherever you want to begin.
Okay. I'm probably going to jump all over the place, but for starters, I have about 7.5 years of sobriety. My recovery date is November 22nd, 2013, and that date did not come without a price, I should say. So now I'll go back through my life story. I was born and raised in a small town in Yankton, South Dakota, and so I grew up like in a predominantly white society. The reservations were nearby, and I would go to my grandparents for the summer or for the weekend, and I would start dancing in the powwow when I was probably about 7 years old, which was nice, and I have never forgotten the powwow ways or, you know, how to dance or any of that. Something that still brings me a lot of joy to this day and something that I'm very proud of. So throughout my childhood, like what I seen was alcoholism and drug addiction on both of my parents' families and in their lives. My dad walked out of my life when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and I hardly seen him. Maybe I've seen him a handful of times since that time. So throughout my life, I've kind of grappled with that, with the abandonment issues from him, and also seeing alcoholism in my mom's life too. She was in and out of sobriety. And for anybody who knows what it's like to be an adult child of an alcoholic, I can relate to everything and all the symptoms that they have. I identify with those. I seen too much at a young age. I feel like I had to grow up too fast, and this affected my recovery in later years, because I used to have challenges with like having fun, because I felt like I always had to be in that responsible role, or, you know, don't have fun or don't show emotions. So a lot of the ACOA characteristics are things that I continue to work on this day. Another significant experience in my childhood would have been the loss of my paternal grandmother. And this was so heartbreaking, because throughout my childhood, like when all this abuse and alcoholism was going on, I could always go to her house and she would cook for me, bathe me, and just treat me like nothing I've ever felt. Like the love was there and it was unconditional, and I felt such a sense of safety with her. And I just loved her the most in my childhood. So when she left, that really broke my heart. And I've struggled with grief for her like my entire life. When she passed, I remember everybody kept telling me, stop crying, stop crying. And like they kept saying that I was crying too much without helping me to process through it, or saying, hey, it's okay to be sad. You know, this is what happens, or what happened to her is natural. It's a natural part of life. And so I would say that grief is there, and it comes and it goes. And I don't know what the remedy is for that, but I just know that I really loved her. And then I lost my other grandma. I was probably like 10 years old when she died, and that kind of set off a lot of other events. And then I tried drinking alcohol when I was in sixth grade, and I really didn't like the taste of Budweiser. And I guess what drew me to it is I seen a lot of people who were drinking beer, well, obviously throughout my childhood, and it made them feel different. So I thought that beer must taste good, or why would everybody be wanting to drink it all the time? But lo and behold, I didn't like the taste of Budweiser, so I just set it back down and left it. But at age 13, somehow, some way, I got offered some wine coolers, and that set in motion like an early start to my alcoholism. And then I started smoking weed when I was 13 years old, and then more alcohol and getting drunk. And by age 15, I was pregnant, and I dropped out in the eighth grade, and I gave birth to my oldest daughter at age 16. And I was still dealing with my addictions throughout that. I didn't drink or do drugs when I was pregnant with her, but after I had her, I tried meth, and I liked it so much that I kept doing it that night. And pretty soon, the last thing I remember is driving my car, and then my friend said that they looked over at me and my eyes had like rolled back. So they called 911, and I had overdosed on meth and was having a grand mal seizure, which is like the worst and biggest seizure you could ever have. And so they took me to the hospital, and I was in the ICU for like 5 days. And after that, they said that I was lucky that I didn't have any permanent brain damage, because that seizure could have did it all, and it could have killed me. And that wasn't even a wake-up call for me at the time, because I still went back to drugs, went back to drinking. And then I got pregnant again, and at 17, I gave birth to my son. And like throughout these, I was just a kid, like thinking that I wanted to be an adult. And then I got addictions in there. So like my life was really out of control. And I had moved out of my mom's house when I was 15 years old because of my pregnancy. And so I was just like out of control. And then I was with their dad, and he went away to prison. And after our split, I just kind of started back into my addictions at a heavier speed and a heavier rate. And I was trying to hold it together, and I was working at a fast food store or a fast food restaurant. And I stayed there till I was like 20. And I went back to school, and I got my GED, and I even was nominated for a scholarship, and I received it. They awarded it to me. But 1 month in, I got into the party scene at college, and I was partying all the time, doing cocaine. And before I know it, I lost my job. I lost my schooling. I lost everything, and my life just kind of spun out of control. And I started doing meth a lot more because of a traumatic event and another series of events that I just never dealt with and was just like going about living my life. And so I ended up losing my kids. My mom actually took them. She stepped forward and got guardianship of them when they were 3 and 4 years old. And after that, I went heavier into my addictions. And what usually happens when I go into my addictions is I'll get in trouble with the law because I'll slip up somewhere or I'll do something stupid. So that's exactly what happened. I got in trouble. And throughout this whole time period, I was like collecting MIPs, DUIs, thefts, all kinds of just like criminal mischief. I was just lost. So I get in trouble and I get put on probation. And during my early 20s, like I went to treatment several times, but nothing really ever stuck. And I felt like I was just going to appease the courts or appease my mom, who at this time was sober and who wanted me to get sober. But I just never really took anything serious in this part of my life. And then I would say when I was about 24, I got in trouble, and I was in a lot of trouble. And so I took the probation and I went through treatment again, and I had 2 years of sobriety then. And it was nice, but what I ended up doing was getting in a relationship in the three-quarter way house. So, you know, they always tell you not to do that, but I never have really listened to anybody. So I went ahead and did it. And when he relapsed on alcohol, I relapsed. I got a DUI charge. And then he ended up cheating on me. And as I was in work release on the DUI charge, I caught another charge because I went to my house when I was on work release. So they charged me with escape or absconding, and I ended up going to state prison that time. And when I was in there for 6 months, I thought I wanted to be sober, and I thought about all these things, and then I was dealing with the heartache of him being with somebody else and all this other stuff that I've been carrying up until this point in my life. Like, I was just carrying all of this stuff with me around. Like, all my baggage was just piling up and getting heavier. So when I got out, I told myself I was going to be sober and I was going to just isolate or, you know, just stay away from everybody as my means of staying sober and staying good. So that's what I did, and that lasted about 30 days, and then I relapsed. I met a guy, and he was on meth, and at first I thought I could be strong and, you know, say no and not do it, but eventually, you know, as they say, you hang out in a barbershop long enough, you get a haircut. So that's exactly what happened. I ended up relapsing with him and ended up being in a domestic violence relationship where at the end of it, he almost killed me. He tried to kill me, actually, and it didn't happen, but that's another piece of my baggage that I carried around for a long time. I didn't get any help for that situation. I felt a lot of shame about it, and so I carried that around too. And then I plunged deeper into my meth addiction. And I was just working at this time and doing, like, basically just working to support my habit. Like, I was a functioning addict at this time in my life. And that was like in 2008. And in between, I would try to go to college or I would try to do these things, but I never finished them. And, you know, that's another hallmark symptom of an alcoholic is we procrastinate a lot or put things off. And that's what I did. Like, I would start up these attempts or these projects and I would never finish them because my addiction would be calling me. And it's like they say, you know, if we don't work a program, that addiction grows stronger. And that's exactly what was going on. And I was trying to white knuckle it as best as I could, but it wasn't working. And so I'm back in my addiction. And then in 2008, I get it wasn't a knock at the door exactly, but it was like being surrounded by a U.S. Marshal and saying that I was being federally indicted and he had a gun on me. And it was really scary. And they were charging me with conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine. And that was another side effect from me using, because I really was just like using and selling and just involved in that street life at that time. So it finally caught up to me and I got indicted, and they brought me to Omaha, Nebraska, because this is where federal holding was. And they basically told me I wasn't going to get out for a long, long time and I was going to be locked up. And so I was feeling very depressed and I felt hopeless at that point. I didn't think, you know, I really wasn't even thinking about a future. As my track record had shown up until that point, like I was just living for the day. Like I was living for my next drink or drug. And I thought that a good day meant when I had alcohol in my fridge, weed next to me, or some type of cocaine or meth in my house. And I thought, you know, that that was a good day. And my thinking was just so distorted back then, and so fixated on drugs and alcohol as a means of making me happy. Like I was always looking outside of myself to feel an inner need or fill that hole, like they say you have, like that, where we try to stuff ourselves with these things and it's never full, or we will never have enough. So that's what was basically going on with me. And then So I go here to federal holding. They let me out on pretrial release to go to treatment. And so I do that. And then the whole time, though, they're telling me, you know, that you're going to be going away for a long time. And I didn't want to believe it. Part of me, like, had some hope that, oh, well, maybe I'll get probation or something. But it didn't happen. So in 2009, I was told I could go home for 6 weeks, and then I had to self-surrender to federal prison. So I did that, but in the meantime, like after treatment, halfway house, I was like scraping by. Like I was working 3 jobs to try to make my halfway house fee. And at this point, I met a woman who I asked to sponsor me in the AA program, and she agreed to, on a temporary basis, of course. So that's how our relationship started off. She started sponsoring me in 2008, and she is still my sponsor today, thank goodness. So she's a great lady. Some of the things that attracted me to her were her happiness, her loving attitude, and just her positivity. And at that point in time, you know, that was something that I needed, because I felt like I was in the depths of despair. I was hopeless. I was scared. I didn't know what to expect in recovery. And I didn't think I could do it. You know, I wouldn't say, you know, that I had any visions of staying sober for the rest of my life at that point in time. I just didn't know what to think. So I go to federal prison in 2009, and I'm there until 2012, when I get released to a federal halfway house. I start working, but I'm kind of going to meetings, but I'm not really working a program. So in 2013, I relapse. You know how they say to change your playmates and playgrounds and playthings? Well, I didn't listen to that, and I went back around people who were using, and pretty soon I'm using. And in November of 2013, I was going to see my son out of town, and on the way there, I stopped at a friend's house, and they were having a party, and I was trying to be strong and say, no, you know, I don't want to drink, and ended up drinking, and ended up getting, like, blackout drunk, and when I came to, I was in the jail cell there. And I was being charged with open container. I wasn't driving my car. Somebody else was, and they fled the scene. So they took me to jail. And I just woke up feeling like so much hell, or like I was just sick. And then I was really feeling it because I was supposed to be there for my son's birthday, and here I am sitting in jail. And the reason that that was so significant to me, like to be there for his birthday, was because before I got sent away, my son, he was probably like about 10 or 11 years old. And I remember them coming to the treatment center after I had gotten indicted, and he was clinging to me so bad. Like he was scared and he didn't want me to go away. So like that image is forever burned in my mind, along with what's coming up next. So when I get bonded out of jail and I go to where he's at, and he just looks at me and like a look of disgust or something, like you're going back to your old ways, or you haven't changed, or I don't know. That's just what it looked like, how he looked at me. And that hurt me because I still had that other image of him clinging to me burned in my mind. So after that, I decided, or I didn't really decide on my own. I had some nudging from the court system to go to treatment. So I did an eval, and they recommended outpatient because I had actually stayed sober after that. And so I started outpatient, I want to say like in the beginning of 2014, but my sobriety date is November 22nd, 2013. So I graduated outpatient, and I had my job through this all, and I'm working, and then I start going to school. And I started going to school because I was working at this hotel, and I really didn't want to be there for the rest of my life. I started resenting working there and wondering what else was out there. So I went and asked a few people about options, like for education. I actually went in for some vocational training, like to be a CNA or something. But what ended up happening is I ended up going back to college, and I really didn't think I could do it in the beginning. I'm glad I had a good advisor who believed in me, because if I didn't have these people who believed in me on my journey, I don't know where I'd be. But she strongly suggested and built me up, and you know, she's like, you scored high, and why haven't you been back to school? And I just didn't feel like it was for me. But so I end up staying in school, and then I get pregnant in 2015 with my youngest, and she has never seen me. She has never seen me drunk. She has never seen me high on drugs, by the grace of God. And she really, you know, she's a delight. So like after I had her, I stayed in recovery, stayed in college, got my associates, went on to get my bachelor's, and I'm employed as a substance abuse counselor right now, which I never would have dreamed I would do. If somebody would have told me back then, you know, like in 2008 or maybe even in 2012 when I got out of prison, if somebody would have told me that I would be doing that in the future, I don't think that I would have believed them, because I don't think I would have believed that I had the ability or the desire to do all that. But I did, and I did it by, you know, working a program, taking things one day at a time, having a sponsor, reaching out to other people. Some of the groups that I go to are AA, NA, Talking Circle, church, or other positive support groups. And I made friends who are in recovery, who are still my friends today. And, you know, we don't have to bond over a bowl of weed or meth or drinking. We can just bond over coffee, and that's fantastic, and I'm happy with that today. Some of the other things in my sobriety that I had to learn in order to stay sober were to be mindful of how I felt, use my tools that I had learned in AA, practice a spiritual life. I'm not perfect, but I try. I get up and try every day. Staying focused on my goals. My youngest daughter has helped me learn how to be a sober mother, and learn how to be an active mother, which was something, you know, I didn't get to do with my oldest two kids because of my addictions back then. And I feel like, you know, it's been a blessing to be a mother as a as an older individual and as a sober person. I think that that's another blessing that I was given. And I got back into powwow dancing, and my daughter does powwow dancing with me. So I'm teaching her those ways too. My sponsor has been with me since 2008, and we exchange gratitude lists and talk. And when the pandemic isn't going on or the cases aren't so high, we will resume meetings, but we do meet at least once a month over Zoom. I have a grandson who also keeps me grounded and focused on today and focused on being sober. Between those two little ones and my dog, I feel like I have, you know, good motivation to stay on the right track. My life today is better than I could have ever expected. And it doesn't mean that I have the absolute best of everything, but it means that I'm content with what I do have. And I'm grateful for everything that I have today. And I never would have thought I would be at where I'm at today. I'm a homeowner. I'm buying my house. And I have this little girl with me all the time. And I have my grandson in my life. And my oldest two kids, you know, our relationships can be a little rocky, but we work through them one day at a time. And I feel like I owe a lot to the Creator or to God, because I think if I didn't have a relationship with my definition of the Creator God, then I don't know, you know, where I'd be at. I feel like prayer has saved me a lot. And I think that other people praying for me has helped. And I think trying to be conscious of this power in the universe has helped me a lot too. And going to meetings helps. Reading my daily meditations helps me. Talking to other sober people helps me. And even helping those who are struggling in their addictions helps me too. So yeah, I'm just grateful, you know, that I was asked to speak on this show, and I'm grateful for everything that I have today. And I just try to do life one day at a time, because that's all that we do have. And another thing that I do a lot is I practice letting go, because I'm the type of alcoholic and addict who likes to hold on to stuff and nurse grudges. But as long as I'm conscious of that and I can catch myself, or my sponsor or my sober friends can catch me when I'm doing that and help me to see things another way, then I'll eventually work through it. My life isn't perfect today, but it is what it is, and I know that things will work out. I have hope today, which I didn't have before. So I think that hope, faith, and love are important ingredients in anybody's life, because without those, you know, we really don't have much. So that's about it for my story.
Well, that was an amazing story, and I appreciate you coming on tonight to tell us your story.
You're welcome. Thank you. I'm honored.
Well, I'm very honored to have you on. With this being said, we will go ahead and conclude the show, and I appreciate it very much that you took the time to come on and talk. And I also wanted to tell everybody else out there that I hope that they took something from your story tonight and they keep it with them. And, you know, just take something from what was said this evening. But anyway, I wanted to wish everyone a good evening and have a great night. And thank you so, so much for coming on and sharing with us. And just have a great evening. And we'll see everybody on Wednesday.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye.